Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Maggs with 30 minutes on South African and global news. We are live and then up as a podcast. Interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, all in a concise and informative update. It's Wednesday, the 19th of June. Coming up on the program on this inauguration day, a senior political figure looks back over 30 years of democracy. How optimistic should we be about the new political journey, new era or new error, asks a leading political commentator. Are young South Africans on the new political caravan? South Africa's media landscape under threat as News 24 shuts down key print titles and police on an attack at an IEC warehouse. Cyril Ramaphosa being sworn in as South Africa's president at the Union Buildings today. According to the presidency, the inauguration is being attended by at least 18 heads of state and government worldwide. Now, someone who over the years has been close to the heart of politics and government is the Reverend Frank Chikane, and I want to get his thoughts on today. And Reverend Chikane, as we celebrate then 30 years of democracy, I'm wondering to myself, what emotions, what memories come to mind when you reflect on that first presidential inauguration in 1994.
Yeah, no, you can hear there's lots of noise where I am. But I mean, this is a huge achievement for South Africa. There's excitement everywhere. What excites me most is that we designed this system. We created a constitution for South Africa, a constitutional state which no individual can interfere with. And that we are the best of democracies you can find. And today I can see everything that we design in place. And that's what for me it's exciting, that we can do it peacefully. Whatever the challenges we may have, South Africans are really fit to make sure that the right thing is done.
Reverend Chikane, as you look back, how do you assess the progress that this country has made in terms of democratic consolidation over the past three decades?
No, in terms of democracy, I think we've made huge progress. In fact, I mean, would be considered as one of the best democratic machines in the world. I think the issues for me, it's not really about the democratic system because I think it is working. We have to fix it, though. We had a proportional representation, which was good for the beginning to make sure minorities are covered. Looks like now people want to have a constituency system where they can make sure that people take responsibility for governance and be accountable. But I think for me, the real issue, it's the economic. And if we can deal with the economic challenges, we'll be a winning country.
Reverend Chikane, do you think it would be an easy shift from a proportional representation system to one of constituency?
It shouldn't be difficult. Remember, there was an attempt to do that during the Slabbert Commission, you remember. But it was too early. If we did it at that time, it would have excluded the minorities completely and would have had just one party governing. And we wanted to make sure the minorities are taken care of. But I think South Africa is now properly integrated and that we need to begin to work as if there are no minorities amongst us, but make sure that those who are minorities are taken care of. And so in that regard, South Africa should be prepared. I think it's a matter of time. People try to force it at the wrong time. They introduce issues of independence, which can work in this type of a system. And I did warn them about them at that time. But I think the time is coming for us to fix it, yeah.
Reverend Chikane, as we speak, we are about to enter a new phase of democracy, and that is a government of national unity or a grand coalition or whatever you want to call it. Are you concerned about the way in which this might be set up and whether it can make any progress? Or do you think our democracy is robust enough to allow this, to enable this to work?
Yeah, no, our democracy is robust enough to deal with this. I'm not too worried about it. Remember, these are players. You've got players who have to play the game, and I think they have to negotiate their parties. They've got their own interests. The key issue is whether we can keep the stability of the country, we can make sure systems work, and that we follow the constitution and protect people. Because I think that's what this constitution is about. It is protecting people, especially the rights of individuals and groups of people who need to be protected, who might be minorities themselves. So we take care of everybody in this country. Anybody who wants to set up a system that's one against the other is not building one South Africa. We need to build one South Africa. But we also must deal with the inequalities that have been created by apartheid. We've not succeeded yet. That's why the National Democratic Revolution should still continue, because we have not achieved the objectives that we set ourselves for.
Reverend Chikane, as this new government settles, as a new cabinet is appointed, what do you think the immediate two or three priorities are then that it needs to set its mind to?
The immediate priorities for me is to meet the basic needs of the people. We need a government that works. I didn't refer to this earlier when you asked the question about South Africa, but let me just say, we must accept that there was a capture of the governing party at one stage, which led to a capture of the state, which led to a state system that did not meet the interests of the people, and people used it to meet their needs. I think the commissions helped us to unravel that, and we had 5 years to try to clean it. We didn't complete the process. I think we are now at that level where we can now be able to deliver the services that people need, so that people don't go to government for their own interests, faction or friends or business acquaintances. We need to make sure that anybody who's in government is there to serve the people.
And finally, Reverend Chikane, in that respect, are you optimistic?
Well, I'm an eternal optimist. If we looked at the nuclear weapons, chemical weapons, the strongest army on the African continent, well-oiled military machine, we took it on and we ended that system. There's nothing that can stand between us and the freedom of the people. I mean, some of us who are still alive will give our lives again if this is challenged. Yeah.
Reverend Frank Chikane, thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
All right, so what does this new political landscape, this new political geography look like? And how important, I wonder, is tone, rationality, robust debate, and finding some sort of balance? My next guest says there is potential for either new era or new era. I'm in conversation now with political writer, analyst, and commentator Mpumelelo Mkabela. Mpumelelo, welcome to you and thank you. It's really important that we get out of this new government rational decision-making among diverse political parties. That's easier said than done, isn't it?
True, Jeremy. Thank you for having me. It's a very difficult challenge that the new government of national unity is going to face, but in light of the way it's being constituted and composed, and if you look at also the draft agreement that they've put together, there is no other way to get South Africa forward than to actually find a rational way to make decisions, while not forgetting the fact that these are politicians. they have to represent their constituencies.
We also know that politics is never about rationality, so it's important then that some form of mechanism is in place to break deadlocks, because I would imagine sooner rather than later we are going to see those obstacles. What would be the best mechanism in your opinion?
Well, I think the mechanism that they've agreed on, which is what they call sufficient consensus, is a very well-reasoned way to break a deadlock. Because first of all, it starts by saying, let's exhaust all reasonable measures before we even get to voting on policy or whatever the issue is that will be facing that government of national unity. So they say they would exhaust reasonable measures. And then after that, they go to the idea of sufficient consensus. Sufficient consensus means not everyone agrees, but broadly speaking, there is a bigger picture that they can agree on, even though they don't agree on granular details. And then a policy or a decision can be taken on that basis. If all fails, then they can go and vote. If, for example, 60% of the members or 60% reflective of the voters' decisions as reflected in the National Assembly can then take that decision in cabinet. So that what that means basically, Jeremy, is that because there isn't a single political party with 60% in South Africa, it then means that you have to have a combination of political parties that could make the 60%. My calculation is that because the DA and the ANC makes that 60%, it's then incumbent upon the two parties to always find each other for decisions to be taken easily in cabinet.
And that sounds absolutely perfect in a political science class, but let me suggest to you that we're going to spend an inordinate amount of time seeking sufficient consensus, voting. That is inevitably going to lead to some kind of gridlock or inertia in a country where decisions on the economy, for instance, are absolutely crucial. Are you not worried about time spent talking?
I'm not worried, Jeremy. Look, there are benefits and there are also drawbacks with this arrangement. The benefit is that it forces the political parties to basically discuss issues, to put rationality ahead of everything else, and then find solutions. So you're not going to have a situation where people say, yeah, well, we have a difference, and then it doesn't matter, I've got the majority, let's vote. As we often see in parliament, when issues are not properly thought through, legislation is not properly thought through, and people push through based on majorities, and then they become reluctant, or if lazy even, to think carefully and allow evidence to prevail when decisions are taken. So that advantage is critical, especially where we are, Jeremy. A lot of the challenges that this country is facing requires practical interventions, evidence-based decision-making, careful selection of policy choices, and pragmatic implementation of those policies. The other benefit also is that if you have a system like that, you eliminate the possibility of always resolving issues in court. You know why we've been taking issues to court? It's because the court is often the place where rationality prevails. All points of views are put before the judges, and the judges impartially decide. We will never eliminate that system. It's good to protect democracy. But I think elements of it can also be adopted in parliament and in the executive. And then we don't have to burden the court with what I call nonsensical court, political matters.
Do you think among politicians, and particularly a new group of people going to Cape Town, that there is now a renewed appetite for that rationality of debate that you refer to?
I don't think, Jeremy, it's even about the renewed appetite. I think the circumstances, the electoral outcome forces that on them. If you think about this, I mean, I covered parliament for many years as a parliamentary correspondent for various media organizations. I can tell you with authority that there were times when I felt like sitting in the press gallery, where I felt like there was a matter that needed to be debated further. But I think the majority party had taken the view that because they are the majority, they can simply call the division of the House. Once they call the division of the House, means let's vote on the matter. When the matter could have been debated further and the public could have benefited with a little bit of more a discussion. So in this case now, you cannot hide behind saying I've got the numbers and rush to vote. The situation forces a proper debate and it forces consensus. However, obviously, it requires a certain caliber of members to do that kind of work. So I just hope that they rise to the occasion.
I'm going to leave it there. Political commentator, writer and analyst, and as he said, a former political correspondent, Mpumelelo Mkabela, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
So we have a new government, we have a bigger tent, but how do young people, the largest cohort in the country, feel? I want to test the temperature with Inam Qoma, who is the chief executive officer and co-owner of a company called Rotko Brand Partners. And as a young business person who is worried about the situation, who's written about the issue, maybe the best question to start with is, do you feel part of the process that is unfolding?
I think in general, yes. Knowing that I have access to be able to vote, to be able to, you know, have freedom of speech, to access basic services, I feel like I do have a voice. But at the same time, I also realize my privilege, that I know that many other young South Africans don't feel like they are represented well by the government, and they don't feel like they heard, and they don't feel like that most political parties show an interest in addressing the most pressing issues that youth face, such as education, unemployment, and skills development, etc.
So how do you think then that political parties could better connect with this important cohort?
I think it starts with representing the youth in a much more clearly defined way in Parliament itself. I mean, the average age of parliamentary members, about 400 members of them, it's the average age is 50 years old. ANC itself, their average age is 52 years old. The DA, 49 years old. EFF, 45. MK, 48. Where is the youth in Parliament? They make up less than 20% of the National Assembly. You need young people in positions of power so that they can also be involved in the process of addressing the issues that face them. You can't expect people that are not dedicated to addressing these issues to represent them. They need to be involved in politics as well. They need access within these political parties, within these political structures, so that they themselves can be able to address these issues that are wrong within the systems, without youth having a say and having a voice and being involved within these high rankings, not just in, you know, political parties, but also in the departments, then youth really don't have a say. So I think that's one way. And another way is to give youth access to information. There's so much disinformation happening around, not just on social media, but in communities and groups. And if you give people access to the right information or the means of sharing their stories and their information, because the youth are on the ground, they know what's happening. But if you give them ways in which to share their stories and also ways in which to get involved in addressing these challenges, let them also have a say in the solutions that can help them in, you know, gaining employment or creating business opportunities, give them access to resources. The youth are tired of being trained. This came up in a conversation I had with Sandile Chabalala, the co-founder of Huruma Bantu, is youth are tired of being trained. You keep getting trained. We keep being told you need access to more skills development. We are overqualified and unemployed at home. Like, that is a very sad reality, is you have so many overqualified graduates sitting at home with nothing to give back to their communities because they are being overlooked, because the older generations don't want to leave their cushy seats in Parliament. Let the youth get in there and take over and have a say and come up with new ways of doing things, because clearly things are not working. Things have not been working. And you know, the Government of National Unity is aiming to address that. But I also feel like it's a cheeky way of keeping the people that already have power in power longer, issues.
While your argument does make sense, there is a counter argument that says not only in South Africa, but the world over, there is perhaps a loss of appetite among younger people for public service.
I think that's true, Jeremy. But at the same time, when you're looking at Africa in particular, our population is mainly youth, and it's going to grow. The young people are the people that are going to be running these countries, whether the older generations like it or not, because of the increase in terms of the young population. So at some point, as young people, we do need to step up. The appetite is not there at this moment, or has not been there for many years, because young people are tired of listening to people that go and, you know, they're doing corruption. They are misusing resources. They don't care about the challenges that young people face. They don't care about the challenges that women face, children face. So as young people, yes, we are frustrated, we are angered, and we tend to, you know, throw away the toys where it's like, you know what, we don't want to get involved in this. You guys carry on. But I'm seeing a lot more change in that. I'm looking at Rise and Zanzi, who had way more young people involved in their structures, on the ground, but also in their leadership roles. Young people that are dedicated to leave their cushy seats in corporates to actually come and join the political movement so that they can have a say, because they know that these issues are not just affecting them now, but future generations to come. And I think a lot of the conversation that tends to happen about young people, people are looking at people that are already in their 30s that are not as engaged in politics, but people are not looking at people before they vote. Young people in, you know, in high school should be engaged in conversation about their future, because they are the ones that are going to end up running the country in, you know, in the next elections, in the next, you know, they'll be involved in these structures, and we need to prime them now to be more engaged. And I don't see that happening. It's like they are an afterthought. But as young as they are, you know, at age 15, you should be engaging them about their future, because in the next election cycle, those are the young people that are going to be able to vote.
Some very pertinent observations, particularly on this inauguration day. Thank you very much for joining me.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Police, I understand, are still on the hunt for as many as 15 men who stormed an IEC warehouse in Johannesburg, demanding to be given access to ballot boxes. Atlende Mati is the National Police spokesman and is with me now on the program. Welcome and thank you very much for joining us. I do understand a case of intimidation has been opened. Could you tell me what specific demands these men made when they approached or entered this warehouse?
Okay. A very good morning to you, Jeremy, and to your listeners. Yesterday, we responded to an incident at the IEC warehouse in Boysens. And from our preliminary investigation, we understand that a group of individuals between 20 and 40 presented themselves at the IEC warehouse at Boysens and demanded to gain entry into the warehouse. And so for they were making several demands, but amongst the demands, they wanted to gain access to the ballot papers to allegedly see if they had been counted and so on. So for now, we do not have arrests. We have been taking witness statements until the wee hours of this morning, and we have launched a manhunt for these individuals. As you've rightly indicated, we have registered a case of intimidation.
Were there any signs of prior planning or coordination among this group?
Well, at this stage, we know that it might have been coordinated from elsewhere. But those are the facts that we are trying to establish. We are trying to establish what the motive is and what exactly were they looking for. What did they want to see on the ballots, and why did they want to see if the ballots have been counted? So we are trying to establish who, firstly, they are. Are they affiliated to any party and so on?
I'm assuming that extra measures are now in place to secure not only that warehouse, but others.
Well, that's for the IEC to comment on. Remember, the IEC has their private security and so on. But I think after this incident, as the SAPS, we will be sitting with them and so on. You will know, Jeremy, that we are still in the elections phase, right? We are on our third phase, and the third phase obviously entails us ensuring that settings like this one, the inauguration, take place in a safe and secure environment, and any other incidents around such events. We are also going to be ensuring that the State of the Nation address that is likely to take place in July also takes place in a safe and secure environment. So yes, our deployments are still in place, but then it does say to us, our IEC, then we need to sit with them as well and conduct a threat and risk assessment. And if needs be, then police officers then need to be deployed to those particular warehouses to increase the measures.
Thank you very much for joining me.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
I want to move away from politics now as we come to the end of the program, and as many as 400 jobs are to be axed at Media 24, as the communications conglomerate has now confirmed that it's planning to close the print editions of Bild, Rapport, City Press, Daily Sun and Sokola Duma, as well as the digital editions of Volksblatt and Die Burger Oorskaap, as well as the digital hub SNL 24. Anton Haber is the executive director of the organization Campaign for Freedom of Expression and joins me on the program now. And Professor Haber, this all comes surely as no surprise.
It's no surprise. It's upsetting. It's worrying. But we have known that newspapers are on decline for 20, 25, maybe 30 years. It came sooner than expected, but I suspect that's News 24 moving quickly and quicker than others, with an eye on rather building a future than being stuck in the past.
Are you able to give me a sense then of what the impact of this decision is going to be more broadly on the South African media landscape and also the general public, Anton, people who still get some pleasure out of the tactility of a newspaper?
Yes, because I think that it's a turning point for our media, because what it really signals beyond these particular titles, what it really signals is an acceleration in the deterioration, in the decline of our local news media. You know, it is true that at least some of these titles will go online, but it's important to see the difference between news online and news in print. There's no question we stand to lose the character of some of these titles, the diversity of titles in our market, because they will now, I suspect, all fall under News 24, which will have much less of the individual titles' character and standpoints than they have as separate print products. But I think it really signals the need for us to sit up and pay attention to how we're going to sustain a local news industry.
Let's talk about that in just a moment, but I am interested in the observation about why character in a title is important in terms of the product that it puts out. What do we as consumers get from and expect from that character?
You know, a newspaper, a physical print newspaper, has a different role to an online site. It's often part of a family routine. It often binds a community together. It's often a part of how one sees oneself. One's choice of newspaper is part of one's identity, personal and political and social and communal identity. There's no question that a person chooses to read Bild has a different sense of their identity from somebody who chooses to read the Daily Sun. And I don't think that those differences are likely to, those different identities and the role that those played, wider than just conveying the news, is usually sustained. I don't think it's usually sustained online.
So what thoughts then, Anton Haber, can you give us in terms of sustainability and survival of this important service then?
Well, as you know, there is a Competition Commission inquiry into the distortions in our market that mean that most of the online revenue and advertising goes to the big platforms. And so I think that means it's incredibly important that we look at fixing these market distortions. But I think that we also, as a society, need to say that something needs to be done to recognize the important contribution the media plays in our democracy and our economy. The old systems are not sustaining our journalism anymore. And we need to think afresh, I think, based on the growing notion that news, it's a public service and a public utility, not unlike electricity or water, that a society needs to sustain if it's to be healthy and have a healthy economy.
What about the role of paywall and subscription in sustaining and maintaining that quality? Surely that helps in some respect.
I think so. And I think the what we've seen around the world, that those that can build a subscription base sometimes do better than they did in print. But it tends to be certain kinds of publications, mostly global publications rather than local ones, that succeed in doing it. And I think, yes, you're asking a good question, because there's been very disappointing attempts to convert subscribers here to online subscribers. And I think one can also ask questions about whether our owners and managers and publishers have done what they should or could do to build online subscriptions.
Just a final one. There are as many as 400 people that are going to lose their jobs at News24. Many of those will be editorial job losses. That is tragic in itself. But what is perhaps more worrying is people coming into the business. And let me ask you a very blunt question. Would you, as a young person, now go into journalism? Would you consider it, as perhaps you and I did decades ago, to be a viable career choice? My immediate sense would be no.
Certainly, one would caution somebody wanting to come into journalism that it's going to be extremely tough and uncertain for some time. I believe that journalism will survive because it's so important to our society and our economy. But I would be very cautious because it's going to be a rough, tough ride for some years to come. Having said that, you know, those that have succeeded in building big subscription bases like the New York Times or The Guardian or the Financial Times or The Economist have employed more journalists than ever before. And so I think one has to ask how that applies to us in this country and why subscriptions are only working in some places. So there are lots of questions to be asked, but there's no question it's a very uncertain and difficult period we're entering into.
I appreciate those thoughts, Professor Anton Harbour. Thank you. And before we go, our daily online poll yesterday spoke about a slimmed-down cabinet being realistic or unattainable. And interesting to see that over three-quarters of our respondents saying the concept, that's a slimmed-down cabinet, is both doable and welcome. We'll stay with politics and South Africa's president being inaugurated today. I want to know if you feel hopeful, worried, or if all of this makes little difference. If you have a view on that, please participate either on our X or on our LinkedIn pages. And that is our program for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We are then up as a podcast. Goodbye to you, and thank you for listening.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.